Time, the march of time. Gum, the world makes new users of chewing gum, take place whom they consider the ablest historians of our day, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, to present their reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the world.
From the march of time.
Wednesday, May 20th, 1936. Today in Moscow comes a report of a scene in First Moscow's University's free clinic, established by Soviet Commissariat of Health. First Dr. Vasily Drabasmyslov. Opens the door of his private office.
You are next, Comrade Kuretsky. Come in.
Good morning, Comrade Doctor.
Good morning. Sit down in the chair there. Now, we will proceed as usual.
Yes, Doctor.
Your hands in your lap. Feet flat on the floor. That's right. You are comfortable and relaxed.
Yes.
Now, begin to fall asleep. Your eyelids are growing heavier. A deep sleep. I shall count, and you will sleep. One, two, three, four, five. It is dark in your eyes. All that I am going to say to you in this hypnotic condition acquires a significance to you, and all will be as I wish. You know childbirth is a normal human function which has to pass normally. The birth of your child will be painless. Painless. All will be as I said. I shall count, and you will awaken.
Of his treatment for childbirth, says hypnosis expert of First Moscow University, Dr. Vasily Drabasmyslov.
I have recommended to the Soviet Commissar of Health that Soviet women have 10 hypnotic treatments previous to childbirth, which will ensure their minds for control. Since November, I have delivered 90 children under the hypnotic method. Over half the births were entirely without pain. Only 11% showed very little result. Our goal is 400,000 painless births for 1936.
Today in New Jersey has tabulated the last Republican primary election, and observers can now chalk up grand totals of the National Convention debits and credits for the three most conspicuous nationwide campaigners. For Chicago publisher William Franklin Knox,
victories in two states, a total of 40 delegates.
For Senator William Edgar Borah,
victories in five states, a total of 55 delegates.
For booming Kansas Governor Alfred Mossman Landon,
today's victory in New Jersey, adding 32 more delegates to his six other state victories, a total of 128 delegates.
Thus today, candidate Landon far outdistances his nearest rival for the Republican nomination. But well do the politically wise know that with 35 other state delegations less definitely pledged, and with 501 votes necessary to nominate, a primary victor does not necessarily make a nominee. Today, says the New York Herald Tribune's Republican pundit Mark Sullivan,
with no important primaries remaining to be held, no candidate has anywhere near enough delegates to obtain the nomination. The outcome of the convention will be determined by actions that influence the minds of the delegates and public opinion between now and the convention. One important influence on the Republican nomination may be Senator William E. Borah's speech next week on the Republican platform.
And as observers wonder if the Borah speech next week will launch the long-heralded Stop Landon movement, they recall the considerate utterance last week of Carl Bachmann, candidate Borah's campaign manager.
Senator Borah will state his own position at the proper time. But as for myself, between now and the convention, I'm going to make a direct exposé of Governor Landon's record. I'll tell the truth about him. If we Republicans don't, the Democrats will.
Today, Today from London goes an order from the British Admiralty.
Commander, His Majesty's cruiser renowned flagship 1st Battle Squadron, Gibraltar. You are instructed to leave your station Mediterranean today, return for duty in home waters, with the 21st Destroyer Flotilla Leader Campbell, the destroyers Windsor and Westminster, also Warspite, Malaya, Royal Oak.
With only two British battleships today left at Gibraltar, two at Suez, the closest shave in all the long months of Anglo-Italian naval tension in the Mediterranean can be and is told in the U.S. magazine Today. Early one morning last fall at the chief British base in Malta, a lieutenant general identified as Sir Ormsby Barnett receives a telephone call.
Are you there?
Brighton, commander of the Naval Port Authority, sir. I have to report two submarines of unknown nationality have just entered the outer Malta harbor. They are still submerged and have made no announcement of their arrival to the proper authorities.
Nothing visible above water?
Nothing, sir. We have detected them by our underwater microphones.
You can hear them clearly, eh?
Oh, quite, sir. Proceeding at quarter speed.
No means to prove them, Italian. What are their chances of striking one of our mines?
If they keep on, excellent.
One of those Italian submarines struck a mine. It would mean war. We have to get them out of the harbor without crash or accident.
Yes, sir.
Not a minute to lose. I'll try to think of a way. Thanks, Braden.
A 100 feet back of a green Sicilian sailing lugger, whirring along at submerged quarter speed, are two Italian submarines loaded with torpedoes. In one submarine, black-bearded Captain Alessandro Winocchini listens to Malta's
Britain,
morning news
Prime
broadcast.
Minister Stanley Baldwin affirms, stands squarely behind the Covenant. And now we interrupt this news wireless for a special announcement.
Turn it up quickly, Lieutenant.
Si, Senor.
Within a few minutes, British destroyers based in Malta will begin important maneuvers in the outer harbor in the nature of a submarine drill, including depth bombs. All fishing vessels are warned.
Lieutenant, we leave the harbor immediately.
Are welcome to
reverse
fish
direction
killed by the
and proceed to sea at full speed.
Lying upon the surface of water.
Thank you, my good British friend. I understand perfectly. Lieutenant, the British have fine ears undersea.
Quick as a British wink, the Italian submarines, like porpoises, dive out of British Malta. From safety, watch British destroyers carefully plant depth charges as far as possible from the green Sicilian lugger. And the grinning Captain Rinocchini wirelesses.
Naval Ministry, Rome. Pursuing orders, we have reconnoitered Malta Harbor. And luckily, I am able to report that I find Britain's undersea microphone defenses entirely adequate and very efficient.
Today in Detroit reveals the Department of Public Works and Health.
The city of Detroit is being overrun by great brown rats, some 12 inches long, the size of a cat, that have swarmed down the hawsers of the transatlantic boats that dock here from Norway. The ordinary house rat doesn't have a chance against the Norwegian and is eaten as a cat eats a mouse. These invaders are burrowing under garages, devouring vegetable gardens, and damaging property. Two children, 22 months old Margaret Berry and 2-year-old Robert Stabler, are now in the hospital recovering from rat bites. These foreign rodents are so wise that they detect ordinary rat poison before they've eaten enough to affect them. The only bait which is really effective against them is bacon, cut lean and heavily poisoned. But in spite of every effort, these great brown rats have been steadily increasing, until it is now estimated that the docks and sewers and even the homes of Detroit now harbor some 2 million giant Norwegian rats.
Today in Washington, the Bell Committee of the House of Representatives begins the second day of its postponed inquiry into the affairs of the $200 a month old age revolving pension plan of California Dr. F.E. Townsend, who yesterday admitted political ambitions for a nationwide Townsend third party. In a committee room jam-packed with oldsters who have trekked by a motor caravan from California to hear the proceedings, tall, gray-haired Dr. Townsend is examined by committee counsel James R. Sullivan.
Dr. Townsend, do you know anything about the Townsend plan except the collection of money?
I think I know a great deal.
Well, then, how much would it cost to put the Townsend plan into operation?
About $24 billion.
And you plan to raise that money by putting a universal pyramiding sales tax on every transaction throughout the country, is that right?
Basically, yes.
Dr. Townsend, don't you know that a sales tax always falls most heavily on the poor?
Of course it does. Taxes always fall heaviest on the poor because there are so many of them.
And you really believe that this colossal scheme of taxation would solve all the difficulties of the country?
I do. And if this army of unemployed continues to grow, I am in favor of lowering the pension age from 60 years to include people of 50 or even 40.
Now, Dr. Townsend, when this California caravan of old people, which is here in Washington now, got as far as Oklahoma, your Townsendite candidate, Gomer Smith, took command of it, didn't he?
Yes, I believe he did.
And he tried to put a little pep into the old folks' caravan by including a few Follies girls and cabaret singers, didn't he?
Possibly. I don't know.
Didn't Smith spend $2,100 of Townsend Plan funds to feed the caravan and distribute fire water to aged Oklahoma Indians?
I don't know about that either.
How much money have you raised through the nickels and dimes contributed to your movement by the old people of this country?
Approximately $1 million.
And what have they gotten out of it, outside of Townsend Buttons and vaudeville shows like these Indian dances in Oklahoma?
They've gotten an organization of 8,000 Townsend clubs, and that's what they paid for.
Today in Berlin, from the office of Reich Commissioner of Raw Materials and Foreign Exchange, come latest figures on Germany's lifeblood, last month's exports and imports. Reports Dr. Hjalmar Schacht's new boss, Colonel General Hermann Göring.
Although German exports in April declined slightly and imports increased over March, Germany's foreign trade again had a favorable balance.
But in London, Threadneedle Street news hawks uncover a longer statistical perspective. In one office, a British banker chats with United Press man Frederick Koo.
Sir, how do you interpret the new German trade figures for April?
Just as I expected, Koo. Exports steadily dropping, imports still high because of demands for raw materials and for rearmament. Germany's 5 million mark favorable balance is the lowest since the export subsidy plan began last year.
Helmar Schacht's plan isn't working so well, then?
No. Things are becoming graver. Subsidizing exports means selling at a loss. Now the Nazis have neither cash nor credit.
Not even credit from London bankers?
Not anymore, Koo. Leave my name out of this, but at their last meeting, the clearing banks here unanimously refused to consider new loans to Germany. Well, excellent advice, I assure you.
Behind London bankers' dark forebodings is an even longer view disclosed by the authoritative British observer and journalist who calls himself Auger.
High official quarters have warned British banks to abstain from fresh loans to Germany and discreetly recall outstanding loans. Apparently, Reichsbank President Hjalmar Schacht's Herculean efforts have failed to stem the tide of economic ruin caused by rearmament expenditures. A new and severe German financial breakdown is anticipated. There are even rumors of impending bankruptcy of the Hitler regime.
Time marches on.
You are listening to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the world, prepared and presented by the editors of Time.
Time marches on at high pressure these days. Ever notice it when you're driving a car? Forever stopping and starting? You have to watch the car ahead and the one behind. It's quite a hectic business. No wonder that a lot of people rest their nerves while they drive with a stick of Wrigley's spearmint gum. It's relaxing and refreshing. Buy a package tomorrow and try it for yourself.
Again tomorrow night at this same hour, and every night, Monday through Friday, the March of Time.
Time marches on. Columbia Broadcasting System. New York.